WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively into, let's see, Oriole playoff race. We got the Ravens playing now, which, you know, everybody knows authors are my favorite, but especially authors that aren't like slapdick journalists like me, like real guys that were involved in the game, making decisions. What are they? It's Teddy Roosevelt, you know? I mean, inside, not on the outside, like the critics around here. This guy's got a book out. I waited a long time to have him on. We got a bunch of mutual friends. Football Done Right is the book, just in time for the NFL season. I'm getting all of my author pals on. Mike Lombardi is up there He's in the other Ocean City, the Ocean City where they don't drink nothing up there in Jersey. He has run football teams and has a book and really is a football historian as much as anything. What are you doing, Mike Lombardi, and how has it taken me, let's see, 27 years now with the Ravens? You almost came here. You were 5 minutes away, you and Belichick and those guys back in 96, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we were close. I mean, but Belichick and I both knew we weren't going to get there. And, and so it worked out better for all of us anyway. I think for the great Ozzie Newsome, who we were fortunate to be with in Cleveland when he came, when he stopped being a player and moved up. So, look, it's great. It's part of the league. You accept it and move on. But, it's worked out fairly well for me. I've enjoyed it. And I enjoy talking about writing. So writing has kind of been something that I've really enjoyed doing the last couple of years. I wrote Gridiron Genius, which was a book about really culture, was a book about Belichick and Walsh. And this book's about the history of the NFL.
Oh, I'm an author myself. All my books have parades and happy endings here with championships and Purple Rain 1 and 2. But when you sit down and write a book, and I'm a writer, and I've been writing a lot. I wrote a letter to John Harbaugh this week, a letter to Steve Bisciotti. I hope everybody reads that out at Baltimore Positive. Writing a letter to Adam Jones as well, who's getting retired here this week. But when you think about a book or a concept, is this – literally, I mean, you're not a New York Times bestseller. It's not what you're a football guy and you have a football idea and then you want to get a book written. And conceptually, Football Done Right, what does that mean? Because, I mean, you have to have a theory for all this to get going, right?
Right. So I wanted to tell a story about where all coaches come from. You know, where are the coaches? What's the coaching tree you've been a part of? How you start that? And I thought there were five coaches that really defined the coaching era. Starting with Paul Brown, who was the infrastructure. He was the software for the coaches. He was the Bill Gates of coaches. He developed the software. He's the reason why we have the profession of coaching. And he modernized the game. And he took the game and the coaching from being a guy that had a whistle and a can of water, and all of a sudden it became a profession. Watch tape, headsets, communicate to the players, teach the players. Call me Paul. Don't call me coach. I'm a teacher. And then, you know, we have the great Sid Gilman in the passing game. And then, of course, Clark Shaughnessy, which we would not have a forward pass if it wasn't for Clark Shaughnessy. He invented the T formation and put the quarterback to the role that we remember the quarterback today. And then Earl Red Blake all the way back to Dartmouth and West Point, where he, you know, was one of the great coaches, and the lonely end where he took the formation and he took an end and made the split end. He's the creator of the split end. We would not have receivers. We wouldn't have Randy Moss. We wouldn't have Jerry Rice without Earl Red Blake. So I talk about all those guys in the book. And then I try to rank the coaches and try to put a criteria on what is a Hall of Fame coach, right? What makes a Hall of Fame coach? How do you get into the Hall of Fame? You know, do you win one Super Bowl and get in the Hall of Fame? Do you win two? Do you win 300 games to get in? How do you do it? There's no criteria. I mean, you look at it, and I write about it. Now, I'm not trying to knock anybody out of the Hall of Fame, but, you know, Dick Vermeil's got a 52% winning percentage, and a lot of guys that have a higher winning percentage than him are not in the Hall of Fame. Marty Schottenheimer is an example. He's got 200 wins, only 9 men in the industry, Dan Reeves being the ninth, and then you have to count his playoff wins to get to 200, have 200 wins. There's been over 500 people that have called themselves coaches. So if you're one of nine at a pool of 500 and some, you're pretty rare air. You belong in the Hall. Now you say, well, Marty didn't win a Super Bowl. Okay, well, that's good. George Allen didn't win a Super Bowl either. Marty's got a 61% winning percentage. He can't get a sniff in the Hall of Fame. So that's what the book was driven about. And then I wanted to tell the story about, you know, how we got here. You know, as a kid growing up in Ocean City, New Jersey, which, by the way, I want to correct that. It is the driest wet town in the history of it, dry towns. I can promise you that. There's more alcohol on the island without the bars than there is if we had bars. But anyway, so here.
Good. That makes me want to visit. Thank you. I appreciate that. No, I've always stayed away from that joint thinking, what's the point?
It's the driest wet town you'll ever come to. And it was the wettest dry town. So Howard Cosell watching Monday Night Football as a kid, the impact that it had on me, you know, a lot of guys in the entertainment industry, they talk about the impact of Elvis Presley, seeing him on the Ed Sullivan Show or the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. All the people that watched that said, oh, I want to be an entertainer. Watching Monday Night Football live, you know, was incredible for a young kid who grew up in Ocean City. And to be able to watch a full football game of some teams that you don't get to see because it was either the Eagles or no one was a powerful tool. And Cosell being the commentator drove everybody crazy because 50% loved what he said and 50% hated. And then you had Brent Musburger on the NFL Today with Jimmy the Greek talking about really betting, but advancing the game. So I wanted to kind of get that Greek. I
mean, It was just the intangibles. Mike,
yeah.
Right?
Well, the way they set that up was fascinating. When you read my book, you'll see how that came about. And, you know, the whole thing about what this generation doesn't understand. But back then, we didn't have iPhones.
We didn't have Sports Center. Let's stop with that. I mean, Howard Cosell was interesting to me. I had Dan Pastorini on last week, who was also an author. His book's being re-released with John McClane as well. I brought his jersey out with the Oiler blue because I was an Oilers fan back, even when Burt Jones was here in Baltimore. And I saw Pastorini play Monday Night Football against Burt Jones, get smoked before. It was the road to getting the Earl Campbell draft pick that year, how awful they were. And, I mean, the color, the pageantry, but those highlights were only available on Monday Night Football. And and I were kids. We had to stay awake to watch it, right?
If your mom and dad let you stay awake, like my mother wouldn't let me stay awake. Like, you got to go to bed and I have to
I had a Monkey Ward's little white TV with rabbit ears is what I had.
I had to sneak out to go watch it. Yeah, and I had to sneak past their bedroom to make sure they, you know, I grew up a Redskin fan.
Oh, you saw. Well, you didn't suffer. You actually were happy. You've been suffering lately.
Remember that time I was. And so all I wanted to know was, were they wearing it? Because I love those old uniforms. I love that burgundy and gold combination. You know, the helmet that George Allen designed, I thought was beautiful. The one with the R on it that Lombardi designed, I loved. I went there. I became a fan because of Lombardi. When Lombardi left the Packers, I became a Washington fan. So
not related. It said so in your bio.
Not related. No, not related at all. But I wanted to know what color uniforms they wore at the game. Did they wear the white jerseys? Did they wear the burgundy jerseys? Because you didn't know. You had no idea. You know, I'll tell you, it's so fascinating how it changed, right? In America, in Baltimore, particularly in Baltimore, bowling leagues on Monday night were the most popular thing in America. Everybody had a bowling shirt, a bowling ball, and Monday night there were bowling leagues all throughout Baltimore and America. Monday Night Football came on in 71, and that destroyed bowling leagues throughout the country. People stayed home to watch the game. It increased bars. Bars started showing the games on their TV. All of a sudden, attendance went up. Miller Brewing Company was a local brewery. They were a local brewery. They were not on, you know, Happy Days and all that. They were a local Milwaukee Brewing Company like you saw on Happy Days. And they took an ad out on Monday Night Football. And all of a sudden, they became a national brand. That's the power of Monday Night Football. That's how big it was. It was huge. Tonight, to any night on Monday night, you watch Monday Night Football, you don't realize how big it was in the 70s.
Hey, Mike, I hear Art Modell may have had a little role in that. Are you going to dispute that? Or are you going to pile on and say that Art, talk about Hall of Fame. I mean, come on now. I mean, I'm in Baltimore here. I printed up induct Art signs. That hasn't happened either. And, you know, for whatever Art's flaws one way, and like, Art did a lot for the game, and Monday Night Football is linked to him.
He did, and I wrote about Art in the book, and I talk about Art. I think the problem I have, Art's move to Baltimore should not keep him from getting in the Hall of Fame. And the Monday night, the idea for Monday night, you know, Art was a nervous wreck that Monday night. There was because he thought it was going to affect his attendance at Cleveland Stadium. He felt like no fans would show up. They would just watch the game on TV. They had the biggest crowd in the history of Cleveland Stadium that Monday night against.
Want to see Joe Namath play, right?
Yeah, they wanted to watch Namath play, and they, you know, it was Monday night. It was a beautifully hot, humid day in September in Cleveland. But Art, you know, for all of Art's great things, he was rather impatient with coaches. You know, three of the top winningest coaches in the history of the sport, Art fired.
Right. Brown, Belichick, and Schottenheimer.
Yeah. Brown, Belichick, and Schottenheimer. And if you fire three of the greatest coaches of all time, it's kind of hard for you to have enough clout to get in the hall no matter what you did.
Give me some Baltimore, because, like, I, you know, Ernie Accorsi, right? We talk about Baltimore, George Young, all of these beautiful people that were, you know, have been on my show. I've been on the air 32 years, Mike. It's taking you a long time to get in here, but yeah, Baltimore has such a incredibly rich history in this league.
Incredible.
And Art being pissed upon for doing what he did to Cleveland, which left everything behind. They had a couple of years out of the league. They've been back in the league 25 years. What he did for Baltimore in putting us back on the map, and 27 years later, two rings, you know, Ray Lewis straight on through, John Ogden straight on through, Ozzie Newsome, and talk about, you know, bust in the Hall of Fame. There's a movement here to get Ozzie in as an administrator as well. Baltimore, man, Massillon, all right, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, man, Baltimore's right in there.
Well, I mean, look, you look at my book. I mean, I talk about Baltimore. There are a lot of Baltimore players in it. Raymond Berry, John Mackey. You know, I don't think people realize how great Lenny Moore was as a player and the role he played. People talk about Tony Pollard today being a great player, which he is. Lenny Moore was Tony Pollard before Tony Pollard thought about it. There's a lot of great coaches and players that have come through there. There's great history in the city of Baltimore. And I talk about that in my book, and having worked with Ernie, you know, and having been there with them, then, you know, I know about it because Ernie was a historian of the game as well.
He wasn't going to trade Elway. I'm telling you, the old man did that. So every time I have Ernie on, he always.
Well, no, I can verify you that, you know, I did not get into the depths of that. I wrote that. And because my book was kind of long, it was over 100,000 words. We had to do some trimming, but let me tell you the story about that. So Al Davis thought he had the trade. Now, he didn't think he had the trade with Ernie, because Ernie was adamant that he wasn't going to trade Bertrand, that we're going to trade the Elway pick. He was going to stay and fight to the bitter end. He was not going to let it happen. And Ernie had a relationship with Demoff, the agent. But Al Davis really believed he had Elway. He was going to trade with the Chicago Bears. He was going to give them Teddy Watts. He was going to move up to about the sixth or seventh pick in the draft, and then go from there and give a boatload of stuff to Baltimore to flip to the first pick. But in that boatload of stuff, it didn't have money. You couldn't trade money back in the day. And the reason that Denver was able to get them is because, A, Marvin Demoff and the general manager of the Denver Broncos, John Beek, were very close friends. And when they negotiated the deal, Bob Irsay was promised two gates in the preseason in Denver. And back then, we didn't share the revenue of preseason games like they do today. Back then, every preseason game was based on your attendance, based on your season tickets, based on people that come. So some teams had no revenue, and some teams had incredible revenue. So what teams try to do is, hey, you know, the Giants always had great season ticket base, so let me play you in the preseason because they put that in there so you would get a good gate. Now that's changed. And that was part of the deal. That was the deal. That was the clincher. Denver gave them two preseason games, which was essentially like giving them money.
Bob Irsay, what a legacy. Mike Lombardi's here. He's written a book on the history of the game. He has his story, and the book is called Football Done Right, Setting the Record Straight on the Coaches, Players, and History of the National Football League. Any AFL going on? I mean, you know.
A lot of AFL in that, sure. A lot of AFL players in there. A lot of it, talk about it quite a bit, you know, and the discrimination that caused the AFL to be great, and how they were able to really make a contribution to, because they were able to go after they were going to go after African-American players. And it wasn't until 46 that the NFL really broke the color barrier completely in football, when the city of Los Angeles told the Cleveland franchise, when you move here, if you want to play in Los Angeles, if you want to play in the Coliseum, you will have an African-American on your team, because they built this stadium. the residents of Los Angeles are African-American, they're Asian, they're all sorts of different ethnicities, and they need to be represented on the team. And so the Cleveland team signed, which then became the Rams, they signed Kenny Washington, well past his prime. He was a great UCLA player, just so that they could have it. And then that kind of permeated, and we were able to start getting African-American players back in the NFL. But the AFL did a great job of going to those small black schools and finding great players.
Yeah, I had John Eisenberg on earlier this week. You can go check his book out as well. I wore my Warren Moon jersey for that one because it's on the cover. Just about black quarterbacks and the path and the racism in football. Racism in baseball, we're all aware of that, right? I mean, just talk to anybody. Talk to anybody that played the game.
Well, they have a Hall of Fame. They're building a brand new facility in Kansas City. Look, when I said this to you earlier, I'm not trying to hurt anybody who's in the Hall of Fame except one man. George Preston Marshall, the owner of the Washington football team. He really created a big movement to keep African Americans out of the game. And for him to be in the Hall is an injustice.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. So with the book being out here and kicking off football season, is there anything you want to say globally about Lamar and just about the Ravens? I mean, Harbaugh with the pedigree to coach this thing. They're stacked. They get injured early. But Lamar.
I love Lamar. I have not a relationship with Lamar. I've watched Lamar for a long time. My son was an assistant coach at Louisville when Lamar was a sophomore. And I watched Lamar struggle. He played, but he struggled. He wasn't very good. And then I watched him play against Texas A&M in a bowl game the end of that year, and he was great. The next year, he won the Heisman. I think Lamar is exceptional. I think Lamar is like a lot of great quarterbacks. There's spots on the field that he needs to throw the ball in. And that's the inside. That's why the best year he had in the league was when he had Mark Andrews and he had Hayden Hurst, two guys that caught the ball inside the numbers. That's where Lamar makes his success. When you throw the ball outside the numbers, he's not as effective. But he inside the numbers, and I think he belongs under center more because there's only one play in football where the quarterback blocks somebody, and that's on the bootleg. And so when you bring Lamar and fake a handoff to the back, or you give the ball to the back and you come out this way, somebody's going to come with you every time. So you're finally blocking somebody. I just don't know if, and I'll wait to see as the year globally goes on, how the offense fits him. But I think the offense needs to be tailored around his game.
Did you hate the Roman thing at the end? I mean, or is it personnel?
I did not like any of it because there was no drop back pass game. Nothing was tied together for me. It was a really good run game. It was a single wing offense, but nothing was tied together.
Mike, I wish you luck on the book. I hope you come back at some point, talk some more football with us here, and continue to educate us. Football Done Right. The book is by Michael Lombardi, longtime GM, writer, historian, Jersey guy, all of that stuff. And hey, man, happy new year to you and good luck with the book. And we'll get together and talk some more football sometime down the line. All right.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Mike Lombardi joining us here. Luke is at the ballpark. Luke is at also in Owings Mills each and every day, getting ready for Ravens football here this week. We're putting the Maryland Crab Cake Tour together. Now sponsored with a new sponsor, Jiffy Lube, as well as our friends at the Maryland Lottery, be giving away those Ravens scratch-offs, as well as our friends at Win Donation, 866-90-NATION. You can find the whole schedule up at BaltimorePositive.com. Stay with us.